And at this time, please help me welcome our speaker tonight. This is Kim from the South Philly Group of AA.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Kimberly Ann Package. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm really nervous. Woo! Okay. Happens every time. It'll stop. Just takes me a minute. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to thank Big Dave for helping me to come out here. He's a longtime friend of mine in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love him dearly. And I know I'm going to be different after this tonight. So I want to say thank you in advance. Oh, my God. This never gets easier. I think I was here like a year or two ago, and every time somebody came in the door, I thought, please let them shut that door. You know, God, I know that's terrible, but it's true. So my sober date is January 23rd, 1994. My home group is the South Philadelphia Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor is Claire Keller. Her sponsor is Dave Malloy. His sponsor is Chris Brennan. His sponsor is Bobby Coyle. And I got a bunch of sponsees that come after me. And man, I just love the pocket of enthusiasm I am connected to in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's why I'm jumping around. Like, I really can't contain it. I mean, that's the truth. I got so much joy inside of me for AA that I never know what's going to come out of my mouth when I get up here. And I'm like, oh, God, rigorous honesty, you know, and no matter how far down the scale I go, I'll see how my experience could benefit somebody else. I'm probably not going to need this microphone, although I'll use it. But if anybody's ears are getting blasted, I'll kind of step back a little bit. So how it works is pretty specific, and it says that I should share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And this is nothing like what I was like. So that is the whole miracle in it. In fact, I was crippled with fear and anxiety and self-consciousness and no self-esteem whatsoever, like looking up to see low self-esteem. And I was terrified of you. I could never, ever look at you in the face. It would not happen. I wore a lot of guilt and a lot of shame and a lot of remorse that, like, I think my head was perpetually hung. Like, I never really looked up. And if I did, it was very briefly. I was like kind of stuck to the floor and trembling with fear. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know how that happened. I have some ideas about it. I don't know if my theories are correct. I mean, I'll throw them out there and see what you think. But at the end of the day, like, a miracle has happened in my life. And it talks about that in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says that I've scratched a limitless load that over time pays dividends, except I have to mine it for the rest of my life and insist on giving the entire product away. But the better news for me is the more I give, the more I receive. The more I give, the more I receive. And I'm talking about of my God, not things. Like, that doesn't even matter to me. I'm not so attached to them anymore. But I don't know. So what I was like, I was born and raised in South Philly my whole entire life. I come from a long line of longshoremen and a long line of drinkers. So, you know, my father was a longshoreman. His brothers were longshoremen. His father was a longshoreman. Most of the guys in my neighborhood are union guys. Most of them longshoremen or electricians or carpenters. Working class, you know, neighborhood, working class family. Hard drinkers, you know, hard drinkers. And my father was an alcoholic. And I know the Big Book says we don't pronounce anybody an alcoholic. He pronounces himself an alcoholic, and he's sober 2 years longer than me in this spiritual program of action. So my dad was an alcoholic, and that's one of my theories. You know what I mean? I don't know. Was I genetically predisposed to being alcoholic? Possibly. Was it environmental? Maybe. Could it have been both? Absolutely. You know what I mean? Like, you know, children learn what they live, then they go live just what they learned. It's really not like rocket science, at least not in my thinking. But so like, you know, I grew up in South Philly with everybody around me drinking, except my mother at that time. She was more like your prime candidate for Al-Anon who never made it there. So my house was a little crazy. My mom and dad were really young when they started having us. I think they were like 18. And when I say us, you know, at 18, they welcomed my sister Dawn. At like 19 and a half, almost 20, they welcomed me. At 21, maybe-ish, they lost a child. And at 23-ish, they welcomed my other sister, Kara. And so we were like Irish twins, you know what I mean? Boom, boom, boom. And they were the kids in the neighborhood having kids. And so they were the ones with a house. So they had the party house on the block. I mean, that's really how it went. And and my father was the middle son. So he had a brother older and a brother younger. And they brought their wife and girlfriend to the house on the weekends. And then my godfather and my sister's godfather and the godparent, all the young kids in the neighborhood were drinking at our house. And I was attracted to it from as far back as I could remember. I mean, I can remember being 2 and 3 and 4 years old and listening to them play music in the house and being really excited about the vibe that was going on and, you know, never wanting to go to bed, you know. And my Uncle Joey was like my favorite of all time because he always had my back in that. That was my dad's younger brother, you know. And my dad would be like, you know, it's time to go to bed. And my uncle would be like, leave her alone. I'd be like, yeah, leave me alone, you know. And I wanted to get my Uncle Joey his next beer and sit on his lap and sip the foam. And I was just really into the whole atmosphere. And, you know, they were a good bunch of young folks just partying and having a good time and until they weren't, you know. And that's just the way it was. And so I was attracted to that. We lived on a little street. And when I say a little street, like in South Philly, a little street is really little. It's got one side for parking and a car can hardly fit up the block. And really short block off of East 2nd and 141 Mercy Street. And everybody on the block was like related or really close that you called them, you know, Uncle Timmy and Aunt Marie and my Uncle Johnny and blah, blah, blah. And I could remember I was blessed and cursed to have these people on the block with me because as my father's drinking progressed, things started to get a little unpredictable around the house. And so sometimes my mother would say, you know, everybody get your things. We're going to go over to Uncle Timmy and Aunt Marie's. And although I may not have known what was going on, I feel like I got the vibe that something wasn't right. And it was the middle of the night and we were headed to Uncle Timmy and Aunt Marie's house. Or we're going around the corner to Grandmom's house. And we were escaping what I later realized was my father's violent, rageaholic tendencies. And we never knew who was coming home for dinner. So I didn't know if my dad was going to be coming home late night with a bag of cheesesteaks from Gino's on 9th Street, screaming, come on, everybody, get in the kitchen. Let's get something to eat. And he would laugh and he would joke. And my mother would be real tense about it because she didn't know if anything would set him off. Or if he would come home and we would scatter to different parts of the house and hide when he would beat my mother like she was a total stranger. And so I guess that contributed to a lot of my shame and a lot of my fear. Everybody on the block knew what was happening. It was a really small street, you know, and people smiled and offered their pleasantries and how are you? And my mother wore like, you know, the cloak of shame with her sunglasses from her bruises and her black eyes. And sometimes we went to school, sometimes we didn't. And we were always late. Just it was really not a great situation. And I think that contributed a great deal when I think back about it, you know, when I feel back about it, to like my nagging anxiety and all my fear like everything was uncertain. Everything was precarious. There was no solid ground and no stability. And so I think, like, over the years, my mom would leave for a little bit, then my father would promise to never do it again, and we would go back home, and then he would do it again inevitably, and we would leave for a bit, and then, you know, my mom couldn't take it at my grandmother's anymore, and we would go back home, and it's kind of crazy. And so, you know, that was just a snapshot of, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, and something really big happened in my family. My father was a longshoreman. And so if anybody knows anything about longshoremen, their job is really dangerous. And they're unloading 80,000-pound containers off of ships. And there's cranes involved and, you know, guys that are in the hold and guys that are watching and all this crazy stuff. Well, my father got hurt really bad on a ship one day. His partner dropped the end of the container and it ripped him forward and everything was just like severed, and you know, he couldn't perform in his function as a longshoreman. It's very laborious, and they had to buy him out to the age of retirement. And he could not have been 27, 28 years old. So back then it must have been 65. And so that's a large sum of money for the 70s. And my mom, I could remember it like it was happening all over again. She was thrilled. Not that he was hurt and not that he couldn't work. But what was going on in her mind is he was no longer going to punch his ticket and go to the bar and drink all day and punch his ticket and come home and cause havoc in the house. And in her mind, she was going to move us all, and we were all going to start over and live happily ever after. We were going to have, we're going to move to the suburbs. And in Philadelphia, that's like Roxborough. You know what I mean? It's like 15 seconds away. And maybe you get a front lawn, you know, in front and Mercy, there was nothing except like a patch of concrete and a yard that was just enough to put your trash cans in. So the idea of having maybe a driveway, maybe a patch of grass in the front and a little yard space in the back was just fine by her. And so we went looking for houses, and she would put us in the car, and we would drive over the bridge to Pennsauken, or we would go over the Passyunk Avenue Bridge, or go over, you know, 76 to Roxborough, and we were looking at houses, and I could remember us running around, and this one's going to be my room, and this one's going to be my room, and everything was good for a minute, except, and I know, because I can relate to this, because I qualify for a seat in AA. My father had a whole other running agenda that he was not sharing with my mother or the rest of us. So we were not really moving. And I could remember my mother's, just her deflation and her defeat when my grandmother said to her, "Debbie, you guys can't move out of the city. How's Chrissy going to get home when he's drinking?" That was it. Drinking and driving. There was never any thought of, "Look, maybe he won't drink. Maybe he'll cut down. Maybe he'll stop. Maybe he'll moderate. Maybe he'll do an about face and drink like a gentleman." Like, none of that was ever even considered. But I could see my mom's face because my father had an ally. And that was it. "Yeah, how am I going to get home when I'm drinking? We can't go all the way out there." And my mother knew she was beat. And so we did not move. We did not start over. There was not a happily ever after. In fact, we did make a little geographical change, but it was a half a mile up the street where my father bought a bar. And so we moved from the frying pan into the fire. And we moved upstairs. And I got to tell you that I was so selfed up. Even back then, I was no more than 7 or 8 years old, probably 8. But I was so selfed up and terrified because all I could think of is, oh my God, we're going to move. And I'm going to be taken off of Mercy Street. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about what I was going through at that time. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes really clearly, right before you hit the third step and the third step prayer, about the alcoholic who wants to run the whole show and is forever arranging the lights and the scenery and all the players so that the show would go off really well. It also says what usually happens. The show doesn't go off really well, but I never made it that far. I only thought about the show going off really well because, like I said, I was full of fear, full of anxiety, no self-esteem, and I had carved out a little niche for myself on Mercy Street, and I had known what child to let go first in the game and what child to let pick the game and what child to let win the game and what child to give my candy to. In school, I learned how to do that. And on the playground, I knew who to share my lunch money with and who to share my pretzel with and who to, like, I just had it all figured out so that I would be liked, so that I would be accepted, so that I could breathe a sigh of relief and try to fit in my own skin. I had figured all that out, and all I could think about was my own running agenda. Now I'm going to be in a new neighborhood, and I'm going to be in a new school, and I'm going to have to figure out who to let go first in the game, who to let win the game, who to let pick the game, who to share my candy money with, who to give my pretzel money to, you know, all of this. And it was just terrifying. In school, it's like times 30. I was so scared in grade school that I could remember being in this new school and having the teacher say, okay, kids, open up your books and we're going to read from chapter 4. And I would be like, oh my God, we're going to read out loud. And then I would go through the paragraphs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10. And I would study my paragraphs so that when it got to me, I was going to read it with proficiency. You were going to be amazed at how well-read I was, and you were going to like me, and you were going to accept me, and I maybe would get away with not having to give you my pretzel money. You might just, you know, want to play with me anyway. Like, all this stuff going on in a new neighborhood and in a new school, and needless to say, I spent a lot of time in the house, living upstairs from a bar where everything was going on, and not a lot of it was good. They had all-night card games in the back. They had go-go dancers. They had number running. They had off-track betting. They had non-AA conference-approved materials being sold in the bathrooms, used in the bathrooms, you know. And it was crazy, and it was packed in there. I mean, packed. They had a shuffleball league, dart league, softball team, pool league, like anything you wanted was going on at 1700 South 2nd Street. And I spent a great deal of time sitting on the open staircase on a Friday and a Saturday night studying the environment and really just attracted to it, amazed by it. Desperate for it, like it was just incredible. My synapses were like firing. And I would be like on the stairs on a Friday or Saturday night, just like this, in my little nightgown with it pulled down, and I would be mesmerized at what was going on. And it would be like the jukebox had the running lights running around it, and the music would be going and blasting, and smoke would be looming, and people would have a cigarette in this hand and a drink in this hand, and big bright eyes and rosy cheeks and a smile from ear to ear, and everything was moving in slow motion like in a movie, and they would take a puff and they would talk and they would laugh, and it just seemed like the smoke would billow out, and I was I don't know, hypnotized by it. And I would watch it and I would think, oh my God, they look so happy and they look so free. And I just want whatever it is that they have. For 5 minutes, I wanted to feel like they look like they felt. I just wanted it so bad. So I did not wait until I was 18 to pick up a drink or till I was 21 to pick up a drink. My first deliberate drink, not the one where I sipped the foam from Uncle Joey, my first deliberate drink was no more than 9 years old. And I had a perfect opportunity. You know, my father's drinking had progressed to such a degree that he was drinking 24 hours a day if he could. He would go down and open up the bar and he would work the day shift and take the numbers and then he would have somebody come on and bartend and he would get on the other side of the bar. He would take all the action and he would drink. And then my mother's tendencies had switched from qualifying for Al-Anon but never making it there to looking like somebody who might qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous but never making it here. So if you can't beat him, join him. And so she joined my dad, and nobody was minding the kids. And so what would happen is on a Saturday night, it would be three deep on every side of the bar. And I know because I was watching it. And after they closed at 2 o'clock in the morning, they would lock up until 3 o'clock in the morning just with their group of friends. They would clean up. And then they would go to the after-hours joints, the IA, the Buckeye, the 48, the FOP, the Kosciuszko Club, the Italian-American Club, the Baritz, Scruples, anywhere that would let them drink until the sun came up. And then they would come home and sleep like the dead on a Sunday. And that is when I would take full advantage of the opportunity to sneak downstairs into the bar. And then I would go behind the bar and I would open up there. It was like a refrigerator, but it was like a dummy. There was nothing in it except their quarter box where they kept rolls of quarters, rolls of dimes, and rolls of nickels and some money stacked. And I would go in there and take a roll of quarters out. And then I would bang it on the end of the bar. And when nobody moved, I would open it up and I would sneak to the front of the bar just to the left of the jukebox and I would put these quarters in the cigarette machine. And it was old, right? It wasn't like the kind where you put the dollar in now and it's like zip, zip, zip. It was like clank, 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 you know, to the bottom. And then I would listen. And then I would clank, 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 clank all the way to the bottom and then I would listen. And I would do that probably three or four more times. It was no more than a dollar and a quarter, $1.50 to get a pack of smokes back then. And so I would get a pack of Marlboro, and I would hold the handle, and I would pull it out. And then I would walk it back in, you know. Because if not, it would be like clang, 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 ching, bang, pop. You know what I mean? And of course, somebody was going to get up if they heard all that going on. And I would get a pack of Marlboro, and I would go to behind the bar, and any liquor that tasted sweet, I would pour it in a glass. And then I would go on the other side of the bar with my back to the jukebox, because I knew how to jack up the songs. When you're raised in a bar, you know how to do all this stuff. And I would jack up the credits on the jukebox, turn the volume down just so. I knew all the numbers to the songs that I liked, you know. I would put them on, and I sat on that bar stool, and I took that drink, I washed it back, and I'm telling you that I qualify for a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I don't remember what I had for breakfast this morning, but I can tell you what my first drink was like, as if I took it 15 minutes before I got here. And electricity just poured through my veins, and all of a sudden, I fit in my own skin. And I breathed a sigh of relief. I think a smile even came across my face, and I was giddy. And I'm talking for the first time in my entire life that I feel like I cracked a smile. I was so wound up, so restless, so irritable, and so discontented at 8 years old, 9 years old, that I felt like if I cracked, I would shatter into a million pieces. I was so tight. But not after that. I was like, phew. I had found my solution. Drinking was never a problem for me. Drinking was my solution. And I did not drink every single Sunday, because at 8 or 9 years old, you can't drink every Sunday. But every Sunday I could, I drank. And when I couldn't drink on Sundays anymore, or Sundays when I could wasn't frequent enough, I began to graduate to stealing from my parents. And on a Friday and a Saturday night when it would be mobbed in there, I would sneak right down the steps and they'd be half in a bag partying with everybody. And I would go right down into the beer box, right down into the walk-in box in the basement. And I would have a bag with me, a duffel bag, and I would take a quart of Budweiser and I would wrap it in a t-shirt and I would put it in the bag. I would take another quart of Budweiser and I would wrap it in something else and I would put it in the bag so it didn't break and it didn't clank, clank, clank when I came up the steps. And I would watch, 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 and then I would sneak up the steps and I would zip around the corner and I would come out the front and my father would be like, "Yo, where are you going?" I go, "I'm going to Audrey's, Dad, right next door. You all right? I'm all right." "All right." And out I would go. And I would go to 4th and Morris Park, or behind their schoolyard, the elementary school, or 2nd and Greenwich Street Park, and I would drink quarts of beer. I couldn't have been more than 10 or 11 years old. By the time I was 12, 40 ounces had come out. And I can remember stealing my mother's envelope money, because I went to Catholic school. And one of the requirements of Catholic school was to go to church every Sunday. And the evidence of you being there is your envelope made it to the basket. And I would bust open that envelope, and I would go to the speakeasy at 5th and Dickinson, and I would buy a 40-ouncer, and I would go sit somewhere and drink. By that time, I had met a couple little girls in the neighborhood who were willing to take the risk and drink, but they didn't drink like me. And there was evidence to that. I had become what the big book says is dangerously and disgustingly antisocial by the time I was about 12 or 13 years old. Ridiculous. Like, what a painful, sad, pathetic life I was turning out to live, and I was 12 or 13. And it looked like this. Everybody would pool their money. I would be the one that was brave enough to go into Miss Mickey's neighborhood, because none of us were allowed there. There was a lot of craziness going on there, but I would go anyway because I was in pursuit of a drink, you know. And I would go to Miss Mickey's, and I would have a note scribbled in my own handwriting that my mom wants 2 40-ounces of Bud. I would knock on her door, be like, "Miss Mickey, my mom sent me around. She wants 2 40s. Come on in here now, child." And I would walk in, and she'd go, "I'm going to put these in a brown paper bag for you, because I don't want nobody seeing you taking these to your mama." "That's a great idea, Miss Mickey." She would do it, and I would leave, and I would go, and I would meet those little girls at 2nd and Greenwich Street Park. And what happened to me was I would crack that 40 because I took the risk to go get it. So, of course, I get the first sip off the bottle. And I would drink as much as humanly possible for a 12-year-old. And then I would give it to you. And then I immediately copped a seething resentment. I didn't know it was that at the time. But what I did know, what I did really know, was that it had to go to you, to you, to you, to you, possibly to you, before it got back to me. And I was incensed. And I would go, "Let's go, you Bogart!" And then I would lean over and smack her. Now, I'm talking about, I was 60 pounds, soaking wet, fully clothed. I was afraid of my own shadow. I couldn't even make friends. I was terrified that you wouldn't like me and that you wouldn't accept me and that I wouldn't, you know, be allowed to play with you or hang with you. And all of a sudden, this other thing was taken over. And they would say, what's the matter with you? I'd be like, I don't know. What's the matter with me? Like, I had no idea what was happening to me. But it would get worse. Alcohol began to grab me by the throat and drag me through my own young life. And by 15, I was having my first alcohol overdose. And I say first because it wasn't my last. I graduated from drinking 40 ounces to Bud to tapping a keg with some older kids to drinking grain alcohol and overdosing. I graduated to quitting school because I was going to be an entrepreneur in the business of sales. And I was going to sell non-AA conference-approved materials in the fire escapes and in the schoolyards and in the parks in the neighborhood. And I didn't need to go to school anymore. It was fine for you suckers, but I had it all figured out. So at 15 years old, 14, I'm graduating eighth grade, and I'm lucky to graduate because I'm already thrown out of one Catholic school, and I'm in the second Catholic school. And then I'm getting into Girls High. If anybody knows anything about Philadelphia, Girls High, you had to have some brains to get in that place. So I was not slow, but I was the dumbest smart girl you ever want to come across. And I get into Girls High, and I'm politely asked to leave 3 months later because I have an alcoholic, rageaholic behavior pattern. And they can't control me in that school, and I'm too violent. So they don't want me there. So I get thrown out of there. So then I try performing arts. Should be okay. I didn't realize that it was a school that was of the arts. So you had to actually have an art, which I didn't have. And you had to do work independently. I couldn't do it when it was structured and assigned to me, let alone independently. So that didn't work. And so maybe 3-4 months later, I'm thrown out of there. Then I get to Howard Horace Furness, which is like the armpit of public schools in South Philadelphia. And I'm asked to participate in the fourth floor program, which is like where they don't let you, it's for incorrigible youth, and you don't get to populate with all the other students. So the school cops bring you in, and they take you upstairs, and you get a math and a reading and a science and a history, I think it is. Or an English lit, and then they walk you back out. You can't hang around. You can't go to a full day of classes. And when I get done 10th grade, I think I'm like 15, 16 years old, I find out I don't have enough credits to go to 11th grade. So I'm now at another school, South Philadelphia High School at Broad and Jackson, where I take the walk of shame because it's a perp walk, and I'm being arrested and led through the hallways out of the school, and I decide maybe this school thing just ain't for me. It's for all of you. And I quit school, so I'm going nowhere fast. And by the time I'm 17, I'm bartending in the corner bar. Like, that's my claim to fame. And then I'm bartending right alongside my father because that was his claim to fame. And we're working in the same bar, and he's happy when I come in because he can get on the other side and drink. And I'm happy because he don't even know I'm drinking while I'm working. I am an entrepreneur in the business of sales, and he's none the wiser. And I'm drunk, and I'm walking away with $200-$300 a night because in a blue-collar neighborhood, it's, you know, a lot of good tippers. And so I'm 17 years old. On a Friday and Saturday night, I'm making $200-$300 a night. I'm drunk off my ass the entire time. And then I am going to the Buckeye and the IA and the 48, the Kosciuszko Club, and the FOP, and Baritz, and anywhere that will let me drink until the sun comes up. And unlike my father, who would venture home, I would venture to somebody's place afterward with six packs for the go. And my drinking was out of control. I had progressed alcoholism, and I was probably about 17, 18 years old. By the time I was 18, 19 years old, I told myself, man, I got to get out of this place. I'm going to go nowhere fast. I need an education. So, again, I was not dumb. I was dumb, but I wasn't not bright. And And I decided to get a GED, and I did that. And I called the school district, and I found out what I needed to do, and I found the closest place in our catchment area that offered GED testing. And I went, and I took two on a Monday and two on a Wednesday and one on a Friday, and I'm out the door with a GED, and I'm going to enroll in Community College of Philadelphia, because without that, I am going nowhere. And I didn't realize you actually had to show up to class to pass in college, or do the readings or the assignments, or take the quizzes, or the turn in the papers. And so I have the student loans that I still pay today to prove that I wasn't making it there. And, you know, it's crazy. But I was drunk, and I was a waste, and my life was pathetic. And I was not a good daughter. I was not a good sister. In fact, my sisters were humiliated by me. They had to live in the neighborhood where I drank and degraded myself and allowed people to degrade me. Like, that's just, you know, that's my story. And it's important that I say that, because I'm a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous who has been reborn. And I know who I am, and I know whose I am. But it wasn't like that all the time. And so for a long time, my sisters were totally ashamed, because they had to hear about me in the street. And, you know, I just, I took a job in another bar. And at one point, a really good friend of mine, in fact, my best friend, and I don't know how I got her and I don't know how I kept her, but she came into Mako's on 3rd and South, where I was bartending at the time. And she said, "Kim, you look like you're dying. Why don't you let me help you?" And as true as I am to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was offended. "How dare you call me alcoholic? What? I look like I'm dying. I thought I looked cute. I had short shorts and high Doc Martin boots and a half shirt and, you know, hair and makeup. And I was working behind a bar, and I was hustling pool, and just enough cheek was hanging out when I was shooting. Like, I was a hot mess. And you could not tell me. I really thought I was the cat's pajamas. And I was delusional, you know, running on 100 forms of fear, you know, delusion, self-pity, self-seeking. I was a mess. And she probably made the best and worst decision of her life that night. But she said, "Please come with me. Just come for a couple days." She wanted me to come down the shore with her, where she had moved and had been living for a few years. She was working in the casinos down there, and I packed a bag for 3 days, and I stayed for 3 years. 3 years, and became an unwelcomed hanger-on. But I found a job in the seediest bar, and it was open 24 hours, because bars down there are open 24 hours, and I had no idea. And I thought I had arrived. I was bartending the 8 in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon shift, and I was drunk by 10 o'clock every day, even if it started with a Bloody Mary, hair at a dog, take the edge off from the night before. And I would drink until 4 o'clock, and then I would get on the other side of the bar and drink from 4 o'clock to 2 o'clock. And then I would leave at 2 o'clock, because that was my body clock, and I would go wherever, because AC, it doesn't sleep, so you can go get something to eat, you can go somewhere else, you can go whatever. And I don't even know how I got home half the time. And half of the half time, I wanted to chew my left arm off and leave wherever I was, because I didn't know who was next to me. And that's how I lived. My drinking was not glamorous. In fact, it was painful. It was progressive. And it was pathetic. My life was pathetic. And God saw fit to get me sober anyway. I met a man down there. Not surprising. I was kind of running through them, but he came into the bar. He came into the bar one day, and I had never seen him before, and I thought nothing of it. But this guy was different. He ordered a Michelob and a sandwich for lunch. And he ate the sandwich, and he took 2-3 sips of the Michelob. And then switched to soda. I thought that was the most bizarre thing I had ever seen in my life. "Aren't you going to finish that?" I would say. He'd be like, "Nah, I just have a Coke." "Really? Okay. I would get him the Coke, and he would come in every day. And it turns out he saw me going in there one day when he was headed to work. And the only reason he went in there and started to have lunch there is because he was smitten with me. I couldn't figure it out. It went on for a little while. And he made the best and worst decision of his life. One day when he asked me out on a date, which led to 2.5 years of pain and shame and humiliation and degradation for the both of us. And at the end of that relationship, because of course it came to an end, he was banging on the front lawn. Now we're talking about a hardworking, good, and decent man that any girl would be blessed and fortunate to spend their life with. And I truly mean that about that man. And thank you, God Almighty, for a 9th step in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had a manicured lawn, beautiful home that he worked really hard for in Linwood, New Jersey, paid his bills on time, really respectful, worked every day, side jobs, like just the salt of the earth human being. And he was banging on the front lawn and kind of gnashing his teeth and ripping his hair out and crying. And he said, "Kimmy, it's too painful to love you. You have to leave." And that was not the first time I had been asked to leave or had been thrown out of a place or had been dumped. So I got it. And he probably should have did it long before he did. In fact, I know he should have did it long before he did. He probably saved my life by having me around for that long, because who knows? Who knows? And but that was the beginning of the end for me. And not long after that, I would be doubled over in a fetal position beside the bed in my own room, between my room and the bathroom, begging God for some kind of mercy to either kill me or help me. And my prayer went just like this: "What will you have me do? What do you want me to do? I can't live like this anymore. I hate myself." I wanted to rip off every ounce of skin that I had on my body and run for the hills and never look back. When I tell you, I felt like I had a wet, stinking, filthy, dirty dog hair suit on that I could not get off. I felt lower than low. My drinking was at 1.5 a Cuervo every single day and lots of long neck bottles of Bud, and I did not eat food anymore. And I would come to shaking violently, and I would drink, and I would vomit, and I would drink, and I would vomit, and I would drink. And then it would finally stay down, and I'd think, "Oh, my God, I got to get something to eat now. But I don't want to drink too much or eat too much. I better not eat too much because I can't drink on a full stomach. I might get sick." Like, when I tell you, I was all over the place. Glass in hand, I warped my mind into such a destructive obsession for alcohol that nothing but an act of providence was going to separate it from me. Nothing. And that night, with that prayer, I got just what I asked for without even knowing what was coming. But I got an act of providence. And as I stand before you and look you in the face, I had a vital spiritual experience. I drank my last drink that night. I degraded myself for the last time that night. I allowed somebody to degrade me for the last time that night. And when I asked him what would he have me do, without a full 48-hour cycle taking place, I was dropped off at 1605 East Moymensing Avenue to the South Philadelphia group of Alcoholics Anonymous, never having heard of you folks before in my life. I never heard of AA. I never went to detox. I didn't go to rehab. I know our big book says to do it. It does. It says we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is still jittery or befogged. So I am not in opposition to treatment. But nobody in my family did it. My father found Alcoholics Anonymous by way of the criminal justice system. And he picked up a state sentence that he was paroled to a community corrections program. And he was halfway back. And anybody who's familiar with community corrections, you're not halfway home. If you violate your parole, you're all the way back. So you are technically just halfway back. And when he would be at my grandmother's for a day pass, he would have to go to a meeting and get a piece of paper signed. And so what had happened to me on that night was I passed out and I came to and I was shaking violently and I was itching and I couldn't stop feeling like bugs were crawling on me and I didn't know what was going on. So I called my older sister, who I hadn't talked to in a long time because booze had separated me from her as well. She got tired of it, of being embarrassed and ashamed and of afraid and worried and all of that. And I dialed her number like I dialed it the day before. I remember it. 215-462-4236. And I'm 21 years sober. She long since has a new number. That's God. That is the power of God in my life. I dialed that number. And she picked up the phone and said, "Kimmy, we love you. Please come home." And I had no idea how long it had been since my family had seen or heard from me. I had no idea. I was drunk for so long. She said, "Let me come get you." And I said, "I don't know where I live." I didn't know where I lived. I knew that I was in Ocean City, a dry town, so I have no idea how I got there. But I didn't know my address. And I didn't know how to tell her to get me. And she said, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "I don't know. Can you pick me up at the Philly bus station?" She said, "Where is it?" I said, "9th and Filbert." She said, "When will you be there?" I said, "I don't know." She said, "I'm leaving now." And I learned about patience, kindness, tolerance, love, and forgiveness before I even crossed the threshold into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because she left. And it was daylight out, and I didn't get there until it was darker than it is right now. And she never left. She waited there the whole time. And when I got there, she cried, and she hugged me, and she took me to my mother's. And my mother was kind enough to let me stay there just long enough to see my father, who was home on a pass to my grandmother's, and ask him to get me some help. Because we had all agreed that I was in need of at least 1 year in a mental health institution because I had lost my mind. Because nobody thinks like me, and nobody drinks like me, and nobody acts like me, drunk or sober. Like, I was crazed. I would like to stand before you and tell you I was the alcoholic, normal in every respect, except for the effect that alcohol had on me. But I am truly the psychopath who is emotionally unstable, always over remorseful, making many a promises and never a resolution, never a decision, never, never, never. And so what I did was I stayed at my mother's that night and I went to my grandmother's speedily the next day. And all the time I was in DTs and I didn't know how dangerous it was. I didn't know anything about it. And when I knocked on my grandmother's door, she opened it and she was terrified to let me in because of the way I looked. She did. And I sat on her chair, and she sat on the couch across from me, and I said, "I need my dad." She said, "He's at a meeting." And I thought, who's listening to him? Like, last I knew, my dad was a drunk and a wife beater and a child neglecter, and he abandoned the family, and he was getting sentenced to some state time. Like, what do you mean he's at a meeting? You don't even have a GED. What could he have to say? Like, I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But she said, "I don't know. He has to go to them when he comes here. And he forgot this paper. He needs to get it signed. Will you take it to him?" And I sat there maybe for another second or two. And God just stepped right in. And I had this overwhelming thought that if you wait for your father to come home, you are going to hit him up for a couple hundred bucks like you always did. and you are going to continue to get what you always got. And I jumped up and I grabbed that piece of paper and I said, where is he? She said, the same place he was yesterday. And I looked on that piece of paper and it said 1605 East Moymensing Avenue, South Philadelphia Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, 1605 East Moymensing Avenue, that's right around the corner from here. And I left and I went around the corner and I knocked on the door. Because I never heard of AA, so I didn't know you didn't have to knock. And some guy opened the door and he looked me up and down and said, what do you want? Because I certainly didn't look like I was trying to get sober that day. I said, I'm looking for my father. He said, who's your father? I said, Christopher Package. He said, there's a lot of people in here and I don't know them. But would you like to come in? Just like Jerry Maguire, he had me at hello. Like, would you like to come in? I had been dumped, degraded, flagged, barred, any fired. Everywhere I went, I was thrown out. Rightfully so. But it had been a long time since someone said, would you like to come in? And I just looked at him and said, yeah, I would. And he stepped it aside and I stepped over the threshold. Sure enough, my father was only in the back. And he took one look at me and he just shook his head. And he said, come here. And I walked up and a gentleman right in front of him stood up and said, Chris, is this your daughter? And he said, yeah. He said, sit here, hon. And I sat down. And that was January 23rd, 1994. And I have not found an excuse valid enough to pick up a drink, a drug, or any modern mood-altering chemical since that time. That is only through the grace of Almighty God and a prayer, what will you have me do? And he picked me right up off the floor, and he dropped me right off at Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I saw in the meeting that night kept me there. What I experienced and what I felt and what I know, as sure as I know my own name these days, is that I had the hand of God, which seemed heavy and unjust, working in my life. I heard somebody say something in that room that night and I thought, I did that. I heard somebody say something and I thought, I felt like that. And then I heard somebody say something and I thought, wow, you're crazy. I cannot believe you are sharing that in front of all these people. And I had to look up to see who this person was. And when I did, I saw bright eyes and rosy cheeks and smiles and I heard belly laughter and I knew it was genuine. And I knew these people were free. And they had a cigarette in this hand and a cup of coffee in this one. And I knew I was home. I knew it. I'm telling you, I knew I was home. And after the meeting, my father said, what do you want? And I said, I want this. And that is the second time in my life that I ever saw my father cry. Ever. The first time is when my older sister was diagnosed with what was known then as osteochondromas, which is a rare form of benign cancer tumors that grow throughout your body, and it's incurable, and she looks like a patchwork quilt. She's had that many surgeries, and my father cried to break his heart when she was diagnosed, and when I said, I want this, he cried to break his heart. He said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, Dad, I'm sure. And then a woman right in front of me turned around and she said, think before you drink, kid. The time to call your sponsor is before, not after. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Looking at this coin. She said, don't you know where you're at? I said, no. She said, you're an AA. I said, what's AA? She said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And with like the tide at flood, 1, 2, and 3 just washed right over me. And I knew that God had heard my prayer. And I burst into tears, and I'm talking uncontrollable. I could not stop sobbing because I knew that God heard my prayer, and I knew he answered it. And that is why I have never had to leave. Nothing has shaken it since that time. Nothing has shaken, has changed my thought that God is loving and living and all-powerful and he's just, man, I just say I won't apologize for him. That's what I'll say. I'll never apologize for God. I'm told I don't have to apologize. I'll let him demonstrate through me what he's capable of doing. And I know I got to stop, so I will say this. From that moment to this, I have gone through the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on many occasions. 1, 2, and 3 came right over me. When I finally met a woman who was equipped to take me through the book, 4 and 5 were not that bad. And she helped me to understand that they were not that bad. Like, I knew all about it. I lived it. And she knew all about it because she lived it. And if she didn't live exactly that, she knew somebody who did, who shared it with her. And I did a fearless and thorough 4th step and a rigorously honest 5th step. And in 6 and 7, I asked God to remove my defects in my character because I don't have the power. Powerless, that's my dilemma. I don't fool myself about that or values. I humbly asked him to remove where I fall short, what he would have removed from me. Because somebody along the way told me that some of my defects are useful to other people. I can't imagine how, but that's not my job. That's God's business, right? So I just keep surrendering. And I got an eight-step list from that first 4th step. And I got the opportunity to look at what I honestly did to other people, that I was a tornado blowing through the lives of others. And I sat down across from people, knocking on doors, having cups of coffee, calling on the phone, searching people through social media, like all of that throughout the years to clean up the wreckage of my past. And not for me. I got the benefit. I got the reward. But mostly so that I can honestly validate and make another human being whole because of what I had done to injure them, mostly time and time and time again. I do the best I can to look out for the 4 and 4. I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when they crop up, not if, but when, because they do. In my life, I'm human, they do. I ask God to remove them at once. I talk about it with somebody immediately. I make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, and I resolutely turn myself to where I can be in service. And that 11th step, I tell you, I live and breathe for the 11th step because all I want to do is go higher and deeper and higher and deeper. And in 12, I just want to be the woman that God intended for me to be all along. I didn't know how to get there. I got a roadmap these days and a good sponsor. So I try to carry his message, AA's message, this message to the next person and to practice spiritual principles in all my affairs to the best of my ability and some days to the best of my willingness. And then I go right back to 10, 11. You know, I became a daughter in AA. I became a sister in AA. I became a godmother in AA. People trust me with the spiritual teachings of their own children. It's amazing to me. I became a community member, a trusted servant in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, a friend, a confidant, a sponsor. I became a student in Alcoholics Anonymous first, and then at Temple University second, and then at Bryn Mawr College third. And May 8th, if I'm lucky enough, I will have completed a 2nd master's degree in law and social policy. God blew the doors off of this thing for me. If you're new to this place, don't ever leave. Grab a sponsor that is steeped in the experience, strength, and hope of himself and that can guide you, his practical experience of the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and hold on for the ride of your life. Thanks for letting me share.